The cub had learned already the first lesson of concealment. Absolute stillness, except for his two round fluffy ears. The ears flicked back and forth, signalling clearly every emotion and intention. He stared at Marion with wide round eyes that had not yet turned the ferocious yellow of full growth, but was still hazed with the bluish glaze of kittenhood. His whiskers bristled stiffly, and his ears signalled wildly conflicting messages. Flattening against the skull meant one step nearer and I'll tear you to pieces. Shooting out sideways, one step nearer and I'll die of fright. Coming up and cupping forward, what the hell are you anyway?
Oh, exclaimed Marion, you darling little thing.
She set down the basket and squatted. She extended one hand and made soft cooing noises.
There's a darling. Are you all alone then, poor baby?
She moved forward slowly, still talking and cooing.
Nobody's going to hurt you, baby.
The cub was uncertain, its ears rising into an attitude of curiosity and indecision as it stared at her.
Are you all alone, then?
You make a lovely pet for my own baby, won't you? Closer and closer she edged, and the cub warned her, with a half-hearted, apologetic hiss.
Oh, what a cheeky darling we are,
Marion smiled and squatted 3 feet from the cub.
How are we going to take you home? Marion asked. Will you fit in the basket?
In the riverbed, the lioness carried the second cub through the shallows and was followed by one of the heroes of the litter, struggling along gamely through the thick white sand. However, when he reached the edge of the shallow stream and tested it with one paw, his newfound courage deserted him at the cold, wet touch, and he sat down and wept bitterly. The lioness, by this time almost wild with distraction and frustration, turned back and dropped her burden, which immediately set off in clumsy gallop for the Jesse thicket again. Then she seized the weeping hero instead and trotted back through the stream and set off determinedly for the far bank. Her huge round pads made no sound in the soft earth as she came up the bank carrying the cub. Marion heard the crackling, spluttering explosion of sound behind her, and she whirled to her feet in one movement. The lioness crouched on the lip of the bank 50 yards away. It warned her again with that terrible sound. All that Marion saw were the eyes. They were a blazing yellow, a ferocious, terrifying yellow. And she screamed, a wild, high, ringing, rising sound. The sound launched the lioness into her charge, and it came with an unbelievably fluid, flowing speed that turned into a yellow, rushing blur. She snaked in low, and the sand spurted beneath her paws, all claws fully extended, the lips drawn back in a fixed, silent snarl, the teeth exposed, long and white and pointed. Marion turned to run, and had gone 5 paces when the lioness took her. She pulled her down with a swipe of a forepaw across the small of her back, and 5 curved yellow claws cut deeply, 4 inches through skin and muscle, opening the abdominal cavity like a sabre cut, crushing the vertebra and bursting both kidneys instantaneously. It was a blow that would have killed even a full-grown ox, and it hurled Marion 20 feet forward. But as she fell on her back, the lioness was on her again. The jaws were wide open. The long white fangs framed the deep, wet, pink cavern of tongue and throat. In an instant of incredibly heightened perception, Marion saw the smooth ridges of firm, pink flesh that covered the arched roof of the lioness' mouth in regular patterns, and she smelt the meaty stink of her breath. Marion lay twisted under the great yellow cat. She was still screaming, and her lower body lay at an odd angle from the shattered spine, but she lifted both arms to protect her face. The lioness bit into the forearms just below the elbows, and the bone crunched sharply, shattering into slivers and splinters in the mangled flesh. Both arms were severed almost through. Then the lioness seized Marion's shoulder and worried it until the long eye teeth meshed through broken bone and fat and tissue, and Marion kept screaming, twisting and writhing under the cat. The lioness took a long time to kill her, confused by her own anger and the unfamiliar taste and shape of the victim. She tore and bit and ripped for almost a minute before she found the throat.
When the lioness stood up at last, her head and neck were a gory mask, her fur sticky and sodden with blood, her tail still lashed from side to side in residual anger. But she licked her face with a long, dexterous tongue, and her lip curled at the sweet, unfamiliar flavour. She wiped her face carefully with her paws before trotting back to her cub, and licking him also with long, pink, protective strokes. Marion's broken, torn body lay where she left it, until Pungushi's wives came, a little before sundown. Mark and Pungushi crossed the river in darkness, with the moonlight turning the sandbanks to ghostly grey, and the round white moon itself reflected perfectly in the still mirror surface of the pool below the main camp. The turbulence of their fording shattered the image into a thousand points of light, like a crystal glass flung onto a stone floor. As they rode up the bank, they heard the death wail in the night, that terrible keening, the mourning of Zulu women. The men halted involuntarily, the sound striking dread into both of them. "Come!" shouted Mark, and kicked one foot from the stirrup. Pungushi grabbed the leather and swung off his feet as Mark lashed Trojan into a gallop, and they tore up the hill. The fire that the women had lit threw a grotesque yellow wavering glow and weird dancing shadows. The four women sat in a group around the long, cross-wrapped bundle. None of them looked up as the men ran forward into the firelight. "Who is it?" Mark demanded. "What's happened?" Pungushi seized his eldest wife by the shoulders and shook her, trying to interrupt the hysteria of mourning. But Mark strode forward impatiently and lifted one end of the kaross. He stared for a moment, not understanding, not recognizing. Then suddenly all colour fled from his face, and he turned and ran into the darkness. There he fell to his knees and leaned forward to retch up the bitter bile of horror. Mark took Marion into Ladyburg, wrapped in a canvas bucksheet, and strapped into the sidecar of the Ariel. He stayed for the funeral and for the grief and recriminations of her family. "If only you hadn't taken her out there into the bush! If only you had stayed with her! If only—" On the third day he went back to Charka's gate. Pungushi was waiting for him at the ford of the river. They sat together in the sunlight under the cliffs, and when Mark gave Pungushi a cigarette, he broke off the cork tip carefully, and they smoked in silence until Mark asked, "Have you read the sign, Pungushi?"
"I have, Jamela."
"Tell me what happened."
"The lioness was moving her little ones, taking them one at a time across the river from the Jesse bush."
Slowly, accurately, Pungushi reconstructed the tragedy from the marks left in the earth, which he had studied in Mark's absence, and when he was finishing speaking, they were silent again.
"Where is she now?" Mark asked quietly.
"She has taken the little ones north, but slowly. And 3 days ago, the day after—" Pungushi hesitated. "The day after the thing was done, she killed an impala ram, and the cubs ate a little with her. She begins now to wean them."
Mark stood up, and they forded the river, climbing together slowly up through the forest to the cottage. While Pungushi waited on the front stoop, Mark went into the small deserted home. The wild flowers had died and wilted in their vases, giving the room a sad and dejected feeling. Mark began to gather up all Marion's personal possessions, her clothing and cheap but treasured jewellery, her combs and brushes, and the few hoarded pots of cosmetics. He packed them carefully into her largest suitcase to take to her sister, and when he was finished he carried the case out and locked it in the tool shed. It was too painful a reminder to keep in the house with him. Then he went back and changed out of his town clothes. He took the Mannlicher down from the rack and loaded it with brass cartridges from a fresh package. The casings of the cartridges were glistening yellow under their film of wax, the bullets soft nose for maximum shock at impact. When he went out onto the stoop carrying the rifle, Pungushi was still waiting.
"Pungushi," he said, "we have work to do now."
The Zulu stood up slowly, and for a moment they stared at each other. Then Pungushi dropped his eyes and nodded.
"Take the spoor," Mark commanded softly.
They found where the lioness had killed the impala, but the scavengers of the bush had cleaned the area effectively. There were a few splinters of bone that had fallen out of the crushing jaws of the hyena, a little hair pulled out in tufts, a shred of dried skin and part of the skull, with the twisted black horn still intact. But the spoor was cold. Wind and the trampling feet of the scavengers, the jackals and hyena, the vultures and marabou stalks, had wiped sign.
"She will keep going north," said Pungushi. And Mark did not ask how he knew that, for the Zulu could not have answered. He simply knew.
They went slowly on up the valley, Pungushi scouting ahead of the mule, making wide tracks back and forth, casting carefully for the sign, and on the second day he cut the spoor.
"She has turned now."
Pungushi squatted over the pug marks, the big saucer-sized pads, and the smaller myriad prints of the cubs.
"I think she was going back towards the Usutu."
He nodded over the spoor, touching it with the thin reed wand he carried as a tracking stick.
"She was taking the little ones back, but now she has changed her mind. She has turned southwards. She must have passed close to where we camped last night. She is staying in the valley. It is her valley now, and she will not leave it."
"No," Mark nodded grimly. "She will not leave the valley again. Follow, Pungushi." The lioness was moving slowly, and the spoor ran hotter every hour. They found where she had hunted without success. Pungushi pointed out where she had stalked, and then the deep, driving back claws had raked the earth as she leapt to the back of a full-grown zebra. 20 paces further, she had fallen heavily, dislodged by the stallion's wild plunging. She had struck shoulder first, Pungushi said, and the zebra had run free but bleeding from the long slash of her claws. The lioness had limped away and lain under a thorn tree for a long time before rising and going back slowly to where she had left her cubs. Probably she had torn muscle and sinew in that fall.
"When will we come up with her?" Mark asked, his face a stony mask of vengeance. "Perhaps before sunset."
But they lost 2 hours on a rocky ridge, and Pungushi had to cast widely and work with all his skill to cut the spoor again, at the point where it doubled sharply and turned west towards the escarpment. Pungushi and Mark camped on her spoor with only a tiny fire for comfort, and they lay directly on the earth. Mark did not sleep. He lay and watched the waning moon come up over the treetops, but it was only when Pungushi spoke quietly that he realized that the Zulu also was sleepless.
"The cubs are not weaned," he said, "but they will take a long time to die."
"No," Mark replied, "I will shoot them also."
Pungushi roused himself and took a little snuff, leaning on one elbow and staring into the coals of the fire.
"She has tasted human blood," Mark said at last. Even in his grief and anger, he sensed Pungushi's quiet disapproval and wanted to justify what he was about to do.
"She did not feed," Pungushi stated.
Mark felt his gorge rise and the bitter taste of it again, as he remembered the terrible mutilation. But Pungushi was right. The lioness had not eaten any of that poor, torn flesh.
"Pungushi, she was my wife."
"Yes," Pungushi nodded.
"That is so. Also, it was her cub."
Mark considered the words, and felt for the first time a confusion of his own objects. The lioness had acted out of one of the oldest instincts of life, the urge to protect her young. But what were his motives?
"I have to kill her, Pungushi," he said flatly,
and there was some slimy, obscene thing in his belly. It moved there for the first time, and he tried to deny its existence. Marion was dead. Sweet, loyal, dutiful Marion, who had been all that a man could ask for in a wife. She had died an unspeakable death, and now Mark was alone. Nor did the word free come too readily to his tongue. Suddenly he had an image of a slim, dark, lovely girl, and a lusty, naked little boy walking in the sunset at the edge of the sea. Guilt, that slimy thing, uncoiled in his belly, and began to ripple and undulate like a serpent, and he could not crush it down.
"She has to die," Mark repeated.
And perhaps his own guilt could die in that same purging.
"Very well," Pungushi agreed. "We will find her before noon tomorrow."
He lay back and pulled his kaross over his head, and his voice was muffled,
the words almost lost, "Let us hurry now towards the great emptiness."